WMAL News at 7. Good morning, I'm Heather Curtis. President Biden set to visit all three sites of the 9/11 terrorist attacks today to go to events commemorating the 20th anniversary. Those attacks killed 3,000 Americans. Mr. Biden addressed the families of the victims in a video released last night.
No matter how much time has passed, these commemorations bring everything painfully back, as if you just got the news a few seconds ago. And so on this day, Jill and I hold you close in our hearts and send you our love.
The memories also still fresh for first responders. Arlington County Fire Department Captain Justin Torelli responded to the Pentagon that day and was part of the search for victims afterward.
That was the first time I'd ever seen a person who was severely a burned person. You know, that was the first time I saw, unfortunately, I saw body parts. There were body parts of children, adults. It just was, you know, you don't unsee that.
Multiple events will be held in Arlington today to commemorate the anniversary, including a memorial race tonight. You can read more in Arlington's response to the Pentagon at WMAL.com. A member of the Kensington Volunteer Fire Department in Maryland wanted something special for his department's 9/11 memorial, a piece of the World Trade Center. His crew was called to the Pentagon because it had one of few ladder trucks that fit inside. When he talked to someone in New York from the 9/11 Families Foundation,
and I said, well, we got to come up there and pick it out. We just don't want any old piece of metal. We need something that will fit on our property and will reflect the horror of the day. He said, you can't come up. I said, we're coming. And in we went.
You can see the mangled steel girder, a piece of the Pentagon, and a plaque dedicated to the victims of the Shanksville crash this morning at a ceremony at the firehouse at 11. Metro's starting work today that will have the Shady Grove and Rockville stations closed through December 4th. Free parking and shuttle buses will be offered for people at Shady Grove and Rockville. Metro says if it didn't complete this work by completely closing the stations, it would take years to do the work overnights and weekends. The biggest project, replacing the aging canopy at the Rockville station. COVID isn't the only disease Virginia health officials are worried could spread. Three people who were evacuated from Afghanistan and flown to Dulles Airport have the measles. The people were in the airport on September 3rd, 4th, and 8th, and then in other public places. Contact the Virginia Health Department for more information. The on-again, off-again ban imposed by Republican Governor Ron DeSantis in Florida to prevent mask mandates at schools is back and forth. A district appeals court ruled yesterday that a Tallahassee judge should not have lifted an automatic stay 2 days ago that halted enforcement of the ban. The upshot is the state could resume its efforts to impose financial penalties on the 13 Florida school boards currently defying the mask mandate ban. WMAL Sports, the Nats fell to the Pirates 4-3, and the Washington football team opens its season tomorrow. Airtime on WMAL is noon. Traffic and weather next. WMAL Traffic, here's Michelle Murray in the Hadid Carpet Cleaning Traffic Center.
On the outer loop of the Beltway, just after the Woodrow Wilson Bridge, you will still find some accident activity in the right lane, though that is not really causing much of a delay, but just a heads up if you're traveling in that area. On 395 northbound, the exit ramp to go on to 8C will be closed. That's Washington Boulevard until about 7 o'clock this evening due to a special event. Lots of events going on today at the Pentagon for 9/11 commemoration. Also, you will find some road work if you're traveling on 66 westbound between Nutley Street and 123. New traffic pattern there. Lanes divide 3 to the right and 1 to the left in the long-term work zone. Now from GarageRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Mostly sunny skies and comfortable conditions on this Saturday. High temperatures reaching the lower 80s. We'll still have low humidity as well with dew points back in the 50s. Later on tonight, mostly clear skies, lows in the 50s to 60s across the region. For your Sunday, we will see some increased heat across the area. High temperatures back near 90 degrees under mostly sunny skies. Will be a bit of a smoky haze overhead from the western wildfires, and the heat that's set to continue through early next week. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
I'm Heather Curtis on 105.9 FM, Washington's Mall, WMAL.
Now, from the WMAL WinBet Studios, the Saturday morning update.
105.9 FM, WMAL. It's hour two of the Saturday morning update, 9/11, the 20th anniversary. We're joined by John Gizzi. He is the White House correspondent, chief political columnist at Newsmax.com. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rick.
As we reflect on 9/11, there are people listening this morning that could have been teenagers, could have been younger. The impact of 9/11 20 years ago on the generation at the time and how we look back on it today. Contrast that with other events in American history.
Well, obviously, one can compare it to December 7th, 1941. And that was a time when the United States also believed its shores could not be attacked. But indeed, what was then a U.S. territory was hit by hostile bombers. So it was on 9/11. No one at that point thought that America would be vulnerable to any kind of attack. But in three different spots, planes were seized and forced into crashed landings that took out the World Trade Center in New York, that wreaked destruction on the Pentagon, and then in Pennsylvania also caused tremendous death. The message was clear. America was under fire and was wounded severely. And with the deaths that occurred then, as well as Americans rallying against an asymmetric enemy, as then President George W. Bush put it, a unique type of foe that we didn't see and that didn't operate from another country exclusively, America joined the war on terror. They don't use the term war on terror anymore at the Pentagon or at the White House, but indeed it continues to this day in other forms, as we saw in the recent events in Afghanistan. Terror is an enemy. Now, Congress at that time was reluctant to actually issue a declaration of war, Pearl Harbor style, on the state of terror. Instead, they merely expressed support. The U.S. would go in and seek out the enemies who had done this, 13 of whom were from Saudi Arabia, but the attack was masterminded under Osama bin Laden, who would be public enemy number one and whom the free world would pursue until that day in Pakistan when Navy SEALs came in and finally wreaked revenge on the man who had shown that America was indeed vulnerable. Will it happen again? We can't be certain of that. American soil was not attacked for another 12 years. And then came, of course, the Boston Marathon bombers. Terror exists in other ways, but for the most part, it's been stopped on our shores. The problem exists overseas. Sadly, it will probably exist for time to come.
You've been a White House correspondent through the past 20 years. So you've been a White House correspondent through the Bush administration, the Obama administration, the Trump administration, and the Biden administration. What stands out to you as contrasts between those administrations and how they viewed and acted on the terror threat?
The Bush administration responded in much the same way as Franklin D. Roosevelt's administration responded to Pearl Harbor. Immediately, the White House and the Pentagon made it clear the U.S. was going to get those who had wreaked this attack upon us. I can remember Ari Fleischer, President Bush's press secretary, laying this out very clearly. Of course, the late Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, was becoming a rock star with his briefings. And then the president addressed Congress and the nation and laid out exactly what the U.S. would do to win victory in the war on terror. The Bush administration kept everyone abreast of what was going on in this war on terror. And then came the Obama administration, which actually dropped the term war on terror, but continued right up through the killing of bin Laden, a front overseas. We were involved in Iraq. We were involved in Afghanistan. And by then, the U.S. had been spread pretty far in the war on terror. Many questioned whether we had to go into Iraq at all, and it had nothing to do with the attack on our soil. The Trump administration began to pull back the U.S. presence overseas. I recall President Trump telling me that the money that they used in Iraq basically could have just been used another way, and the presidents could have gone to the beach, his term, because we had brought a democratic nation to Iraq, and they were electing people who were allied with militant Islam. Under President Biden, we've seen the U.S. keep a promise from the last two presidents, which is to get out of Afghanistan. But, of course, we know that ended very sadly. And we now see the Taliban that we originally pursued 20 years ago coming to power today. It's a mixed bag, this war on terror, and each White House has dealt with it in different ways, but they've had to deal with a new kind of warfare and a new kind of terror.
How will history view the Bush and Obama administrations when it comes to Afghanistan and Iraq?
History is not going to be kind to the Bush administration. Most Americans right now blame President Bush for the involvement in Afghanistan. As for the Obama administration, it seemed to go along, but there was no decisive action in anything. U.S. troops were still in Iraq under President Obama, still in Afghanistan, and they were not pulling back. I think it might be that it was the best way to put it about the Obama administration is a Latin phrase, semper idem, always the same.
I think we all have very personal reflections about 9/11 and things that may have happened that day, things we recall from that day. But you have a unique event that happened that day.
Oh, I certainly did. That was the night that the woman I was seeing at the time asked me to come over to her apartment and watch what was unfolding in New York as the city seemed in a panic. And the then mayor, Rudy Giuliani, came to the rescue wearing his baseball cap. It was all very much a sign of terror brought right into the living room. And she said something to me then that I'll never forget. On a day like this, no one wants to be alone. Maybe we should do this thing. And I wondered for a minute what she meant, but I knew it. And she explained, let's get married. And we did. That's when we decided to get married, to get engaged a few months later, and we were never alone after that, through the early days of the war on terror, right up to today. In a sense, 9/11 was a lesson to all that one should never be alone, particularly because we don't know what lurks out there for us, for our country, or for ourselves.
John Gizzi, White House correspondent, chief political columnist at Newsmax.com. John, thank you very much.
Rick, on a day like this, let's pray and let's hope.
7:16, the Saturday morning update on WMAL. Up next, we'll talk with Jim Trustee. We'll get the latest on the pretrial hearing for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed at Guantanamo Bay. And Jim was up at the Flight 93 Memorial in Shanksville, Pennsylvania this week. We'll have his reflections. Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer will join us. He was on duty the morning of September 11th, 2001. And KT McFarland will also join us, and she was in Lower Manhattan that morning. Right now, off to the WMAL Traffic Center, Michelle Murray is there this morning.
On the outer loop of the Beltway, just after the Woodrow Wilson Bridge, you will still find some accident activity in the right lane, though that is not really causing much of a delay, but just a heads up if you're traveling in that area. On 395 northbound, the exit ramp to go on to 8C will be closed. That's Washington Boulevard until about 7 o'clock this evening due to a special event. Lots of events going on today at the Pentagon for 9/11 commemoration. Also, you will find some road work if you're traveling on 66 westbound between Nutley Street and 123. New traffic pattern there. Lanes divide 3 to the right and 1 to the left in the long-term work zone. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Mostly sunny skies and comfortable conditions on this Saturday. High temperatures reaching the lower 80s. We'll still have low humidity as well, with dew points back in the 50s. Later on tonight, mostly clear skies, lows in the 50s to 60s across the region. For your Sunday, we will see some increased heat across the area. High temperatures back near 90 degrees under mostly sunny skies. Will be a bit of a smoky haze overhead from the western wildfires, and the heat that's set to continue through early next week. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
57 degrees, 717, the Saturday morning update on WMAL.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
It is the Saturday morning update as we commemorate the 20th anniversary of 9/11. Jim Trusty is with us. He is a partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. He is the former chief of the organized crime and gang section at the U.S. Department of Justice. The trial of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, KSM, the mastermind of the 9/11 attacks, is set to get underway at Guantanamo Bay, the prison in Cuba. He's been in custody for 15 years, Jim. That's over a decade of pre-trial delays. Why?
Yeah, well, it's a systemic failure, to be sure. I mean, the commission trials that they have at Guantanamo, these proceedings are probably more like a court-martial than a typical trial that we're used to stateside. And the procedure, just because of that different structure, is already very murky, very complicated. It invites a lot of delays. And in this case, what you've had in a lot of instances is pretty high-powered lawyers showing up at Guantanamo Bay and endlessly challenging the process and having all sorts of appeals, all sorts of complications due to things like classified information being relied on, which complicates the ability of prosecutors to provide discovery, to give information to the defense. And so this has been just a horrible nightmare of failed prosecution and delays. And even now, Rick, we don't have a trial date for KSM. We have hearings 15 years in, but they haven't even set a trial date for him yet, and it could go on for years.
What is the difference between holding a trial in the United States and holding a trial offshore at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba? And the follow-up is, what is the best way to try a terrorist?
Yeah, well, the first part's easier than the second. I mean, the first part is that the biggest fundamental difference is the right to a jury trial. You know, the constitutional rights that we're so used to from ordinary criminal prosecutions stateside give a lot of protections to the defendant, a lot of ability to clearly define the process and to navigate cases, even really serious cases, in a quicker fashion, at least in a matter of a year or two, start to finish, arrest through sentencing. Unfortunately, at the commission level, when you're talking about these proceedings in Guantanamo, I mean, yes, there's no jury, so in some ways that lessens the complication that you'd have with doing a terrorism case in the United States. But the procedures are not clearly defined. And so the defense attorneys in particular take advantage of that chaos, and they challenge everything you can imagine, from the housing conditions to the way discovery is being provided to the way the judges are conducting themselves. And we've also had a revolving door over time of different JAG officers and different JAG judges, and those are the military prosecutors, coming in and out of this case. And so we haven't had even consistent ownership in KSM's case over these years, which is another recipe for kind of disaster. Now, on that second question, which is better? Boy, if I knew that, I could be a pretty rich guy, because there's no proof that the commission setting is going to work very well. But at the same time, I don't think many of us want to see routine, or as a matter of routine, terrorism trials at the level of KSM in our civil court system. I mean, these are defendants who will use it as a soapbox. They'll use it as an opportunity to blast our country and our system. We have a right to public trials. Does that mean you'll have a bunch of sympathizers sitting in the front row for a KSM trial? And then you also have all these complex evidentiary issues, such as the use of classified information, of evidence derived from foreign countries, DOD information, and just good old-fashioned public safety when you're talking about trying a high-level terrorist. So there's a lot of problems with whichever model you do. We've had cases in the civil setting before, in our stateside setting, and we've had some success, but not at the highest levels of somebody like a KSM. So I'm not sure there is a palatable solution, but I just know there's problems no matter which way you go.
You mentioned the lack of continuity in those overseeing the proceedings. The reports are that the current judge that will ultimately hear these pretrial hearings has just 2 years' experience on the bench, 1 day over the minimum requirement. How does that happen in a case of this magnitude?
Yeah, again, I don't know the exact criteria that the military uses for their selection process here, but I think that's also a bit of an institutional problem, that the way military rotations work, it's hard to find a lot of people with the kind of lengthy career experience that you'd get from a prosecutor in, say, New York or Alexandria or Maryland or wherever else. I mean, these are not typically people that have tried hundreds or thousands of cases or presided over hundreds or thousands of cases like a lot of federal prosecutors and federal judges will have done. So, again, that creates a mismatch. You know, when you have big law firms sending high-powered attorneys down on these pro bono cases that they think are so worthwhile, you know, they tend to smell blood when it comes to inexperience and take advantage of that lopsided relationship and file things that delay the case.
20 years ago this morning, we saw the images of aircraft at the World Trade Center in New York, at the Pentagon. We didn't see the image of Flight 93 in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. We heard about it, but it's not something that's ingrained in our mind from that morning. There is a memorial, the Flight 93 National Memorial, Shanksville, Pennsylvania. You were there this week. And what stood out to you as you were on that site?
Well, Rick, before I even answer that, let me just thank you. I mean, to have an opportunity to talk about such a fantastic, reverent memorial on today's date is really important to me. So thank you for that. And I got to tell you, for somebody who's used to relying on words, whether it's for legal briefing or for argument or for trial, I don't think my words are going to be particularly sufficient here. Shanksville, the area of Shanksville is beautiful on its own. This memorial is perfectly done. It's not unnecessarily graphic or political. It's in a beautiful part of the country, western Pennsylvania. And it really sets up as such an inherent contrast to the evil of that day, the evil of the terrorists. I mean, when I went out there, I was struck by the big sky, by the black-eyed Susans all over the place, by, you know, mountains ringing the horizon of this very sacred ground. And I have to tell you, it's just inspirational. I mean, you know, the entire scene is so perfectly done. You think about what these people did on September 11th. They knew the plane was never going to land. They were 18 minutes of airtime away from a packed Congress. Remember, Congress had a joint session going on that day. There was literally thousands of people in harm's way at Congress. And I think if they had succeeded, I'm not sure the World Trade Center would be the iconic image from September 11th. It would have been the Capitol. I mean, the nation's symbol of government. So I was able to spend some time walking around and taking it in to, you know, hear stories about how the flight attendants boiled water to lead, you know, to help the guys on the attack of the cockpit. You know, from my perspective, Todd Beamer's "Let's Roll" could be a national slogan. I mean, these guys were the absolute definition of heroic and patriotic in what they did. And it's hard to describe, but the vibe of the whole place is just reverence and patriotism. And people walk around on these beautiful grounds and they speak in very hushed tones, but everyone there would make eye contact with you in a way where you knew there was a real solidarity, a pride, a sorrow, and a reverence for the incredible sacrifice that 40 passengers and flight crew made on September 11th outside Shanksville.
Jim, thank you for that perspective. And for people that have not visited the Flight 93 National Memorial, how far is it from here?
It's about a 2.5-hour drive out past Hagerstown going west on 70. And I have to tell you, most of the drive is beautiful, too. You're going through mountains, rural parts of Pennsylvania and Maryland, rivers next to you. So it's a day trip that you can pull off, and it's a wonderful one.
A 2.5-hour drive for us that would have been 18 minutes to the Capitol in that aircraft. Jim Trusty at IFRA Law here in Washington, thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
7:27, the Saturday morning update. Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer coming up and KT McFarland on the way.
WMAL-FM Woodbridge, Washington. Saluting America's heroes, 20 years later and always. 105.9 FM WMAL, a Cumulus station. News now.
WMAL News at 7:30. Good morning, I'm Heather Curtis. 9/11 changed our country and the way we live. On the 20th anniversary of the terrorist attacks in the Twin Towers, the Pentagon, and the taking down of United Flight 93, killing nearly 3,000 people, President Joe Biden shares his hope for the future in a video.
Hope allows us to act with courage, to act and honor those we lost 20 years ago, and those who have given their whole souls to the cause of this nation every day since. To act and build a future, not a reactionary one or one based on fear, but a future of promise, strength, and grace worthy of their dreams and sacrifice.
The president will visit all three sites today. Arlington County Fire Department Captain Justin Torelli responded to the Pentagon. He hopes we all use the experience as a way to better ourselves and our nation.
We seem to have lost a lot of compassion in our lives these days. We seem to be willing to yell and scream before talking and shaking hands or hugging. And we need to get back to that, because that's how we built.
Multiple events will be held in Arlington today to commemorate the anniversary. Many Republicans say they plan to sue over President Joe Biden's vaccine mandate. They say it's government overreach. But one expert says the president appears to be on firm legal ground to issue the directive in the name of protecting employee safety. WMAL Sports, the Nats fell to the Pirates. Traffic and weather next. WMAL traffic. Here's Michelle Murray in the Hadid Carpet Cleaning Traffic Center.
Still some accident activity on the outer loop of the Beltway at the just after the Wilson Bridge. Right lane is blocked, just causing a brief delay there. Also, there is a ramp closure to be aware of, 395 northbound at Washington Boulevard. That north exit ramp is closed until 7 o'clock this evening due to a special event. And starting at 8:45 this morning, that south exit ramp to exit 8A will also be closed due to the special event. So far, no delays to report on 95, though, headed from Stafford County in towards Springfield. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Mostly sunny and comfortable on this September 11th. We are expecting temperatures to reach the lower 80s. Comfortable levels of humidity as well, with dew points still in the 50s. That is set to change as we head towards the second part of the weekend. Mostly clear overnight, lows back in the 50s in the suburbs, lower 60s around town for your Sunday. Mostly sunny. It will be hot, though. Also some increasing humidity. High temperatures tomorrow into the lower 90s. We're expecting lower 90s Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of next week as well. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
I'm Heather Curtis on WMAL.
7:37, the Saturday morning update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler. We're joined by Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer. He is the president of the London Center for Policy Research, the author of Operation Darkheart. Tony, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Rick. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. It is the 20th anniversary of 9/11. You were on reserve duty in uniform that morning. You were a major at the time. Where were you, and tell us how the day unfolded from your perspective.
So, yeah, thanks for discussing this morning. I was actually over in my unit headquarters, Stratus Ivy. We were in a DIA facility in Clarendon, Virginia. And I was due, Rick, to go over that morning and have a meeting with Bob Winchester, the U.S. Army Intelligence Liaison to Congress. And we were working on some legislation that would have seen an extension of what we call the mandatory retirement date for people in my category, military case officers. And ironically, Bob called me early in the morning saying, hey, don't come over to the Pentagon because I'm going to be stuck on Capitol Hill at breakfast. And ironically enough, Rick, his office, absent of he and I, was hit. It actually was part of the section of the Pentagon that was destroyed by the aircraft coming in. So I feel that I was very grateful that I didn't have that meeting with Bob. And that meeting that morning unfolded very, very slowly. I remembered it all detail. A very clear morning. I watched. Someone came and grabbed me, and we were watching the TV when the second aircraft went into the tower. And from there on, we kind of figured out what was going on. I talked to one of the analysts at the Pentagon when the aircraft hit. I was talking to one of the senior intelligence analysts. And after that, I told everybody, go home. There's nothing you can do today. Get the heck out of the buildings. Go somewhere safe. And that's how that happened that morning. It was a very difficult time for everybody to kind of figure out what was going on. And we knew there was nothing we could do that morning after the attack.
You were involved in a military intelligence operation which was codenamed Able Danger. And there was an article in the Wall Street Journal in 2005. It was written by the former FBI director, Louis Free. The opinion piece headline, Why Did the 9/11 Commission Ignore Able Danger? Tell us what that operation was about.
So Operation Able Danger was a concept created by the then chairman of the Joint Chiefs in 1999, General Hugh Shelton, the idea of a comprehensive global approach to targeting and countering terrorism, in this case focused on Al-Qaeda. Shelton and his staff wrote a 25-page operations order directing Special Operations Command, Pete Schoomaker, General Schoomaker, to pursue Al-Qaeda. And it was very simple. On call, the guidance was on call, that is to say, when we tell you, be prepared to reduce, destroy, or otherwise compromise Al-Qaeda's ability to conduct offensive terrorism operations. That's it. It was a plan to counter Al-Qaeda at all levels, and it was something done where nobody knew about it. It was completely off the books, and it was done in a comprehensive way, Rick, where you had the best and brightest of kind of almost a entrepreneurial approach to it. The Army intelligence, defense intelligence, Special Operations Command, all focused on this. And the end result was we found through the data mining and other acquisition of intelligence, two of the three cells which conducted the 9/11 attacks, to include Mohammed Atta. And that was the big controversy of the issues. Why didn't they approach that? And Rick, that's still a mystery to this day.
Tell us what lessons we have learned and maybe what we need to relearn moving forward.
The one thing that was clear to me, and I think many others have noticed it within the last few months regarding quote-unquote intelligence failures, it's not the intelligence. The intelligence is there. You have some amazing professionals who are committed to the objective truth and getting that truth to people who can do something about it. The failures have been to include 9/11, Rick, of policy. It was the Jamie Gorelick memo which largely prevented us, Jamie Gorelick being a senior DOD then Department of Justice lawyer, who prevented information sharing. Louis Free says in that article that he could have prevented 9/11 had he received the information that we had. That information wasn't passed because of bureaucracy and bureaucrats such as Jamie Gorelick. That's the key. We have policies now in place, again, that are preventing the free flow of information rapidly to those who could do something about it. And when it gets there, often policymakers, such as in the case of the drone strike, which turned out to have killed an ally, those things are mistakes based on policy, not on information. And we have to be vigilant of making those same mistakes again. They're going to be made, but we cannot afford to allow those to be made in such a way that we inadvertently create conditions for a new 9/11 or allow a new 9/11 based on policy failures like we did in 1999, 2000, and 2001.
We have a variety of people that listen to WMAL. We've got people on Capitol Hill. We've got people in the military, people at the Pentagon. Who should do what about what you just referenced? Who can do what about that policy situation?
Yeah, the people in charge. Look, the elected officials. I was going back and forth with a congressman this morning who has devoted his life to the truth. And they often work to make sure that people like I have the freedom to tell the truth. And the Rick, you know, you live in Washington. The truth is very unpopular with both political parties, and that's the challenge. And I think this is what people have to understand, is that someone like me, who fundamentally I'm not partisan despite what people may think, come to you and say, these guys are going to blow up something and maybe you ought to pay attention. they need to pay attention. And the more we have political parties projecting their desire rather than accepting ground truth, the more we're going to have a problem. So it's a problem in the system that's not going to be easily solved, but you're only going to solve it by politicians, by lawmakers, by policymakers really understanding the danger of their ignoring good intelligence. They always blame it on the intelligence officer, but Rick, I'm sorry, it's bad policy and bad politicians who have caused most of the catastrophic incidents that we've had in our history.
Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, president of the London Center for Policy Research. You can catch his podcast, the Thought to Action podcast, at londoncenter.org. Tony, thank you so much for your perspective this morning. Thank you for your service.
Oh, thank you, Rick. Thanks for having me.
It's 7:45. It is the Saturday morning update. We'll talk with KT McFarland next, but first, Michelle Murray's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
Earlier accident on the outer loop of the Beltway after the Wilson Bridge has been moved to the shoulder, so all lanes are open there. Just a very brief delay. No other problems to report on the Beltway at this time through Maryland and Virginia. No delays. So far, 95 still moves its speed from Woodbridge heading in towards Springfield, and 66, no delays from Centerville heading to the Beltway. You will find a couple of ramp closures in place. The ramp from 395 north to exit 8C Washington Boulevard will be closed for a special event until 7 o'clock this evening. Now from GarageRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Mostly sunny skies and comfortable conditions on this Saturday. High temperatures reaching the lower 80s. We'll still have low humidity as well, with dew points back in the 50s. Later on tonight, mostly clear skies, lows in the 50s to 60s across the region. For your Sunday, we will see some increased heat across the area. High temperatures back near 90 degrees under mostly sunny skies. Will be a bit of a smoky haze overhead from the western wildfires, and the heat that's set to continue through early next week. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
58 degrees, 7:46, the Saturday morning update on WMAL. 7:48, the Saturday morning update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler. We're joined by KT McFarland, President Trump's first Deputy National Security Advisor. Her distinguished career includes national security posts in the Nixon, Ford, and Reagan administrations, and she is the author of Revolution, Trump, Washington, and We the People. KT, an honor to have you with us on September 11th.
Well, thank you. It's an honor, and it's a real privilege for me, too, to talk about it.
You wrote a moving opinion piece on the 10th anniversary of 9/11, and you have an exceptional opinion piece that's just been published this morning on the 20th anniversary of 9/11. The headline, 20 years after 9/11, it's like we've been gut punched again, still don't count Americans out. And I want to talk to you about the opinion piece, but first, you were in New York City the morning of September 11th. Tell us about your experience.
Well, it was a glorious day in New York. It was crystal clear and a crisp, cool air of early autumn. I just dropped off my two younger children at school, and I was on a bus on my way to Lower Manhattan. And as I looked out the window, I saw black smoke billowing from one of the Twin Towers. And a few minutes later, I saw the second plane hit the other tower, and then I knew it was no random accident of pilots getting off course and hitting the tallest buildings in the city. I knew we were under attack. And my initial reaction, like so many New Yorkers, was to find my family. I tried calling my kids' schools, but the cell phones weren't working because they actually cell phone towers were on the top of the Twin Towers. And the same thing happened when I called my husband's office near Grand Central Terminal. I couldn't reach anybody. When I finally found a phone booth, there were long lines, and I was quicker on foot. So I started walking back uptown. As I watched as stores and offices were being evacuated for fear of bombs, and Mayor Giuliani was closing the Manhattan Tunnel and bridges. Streets were shutting down to make way for emergency responders, and people were told, go home, stay home. When I finally got to my daughter's school, I learned that her homeroom teacher had just left to find her husband, because he had worked at the Twin Towers and she wasn't able to reach him. We later found out he had died. The principal of their school was closing the school, but many of the parents couldn't be reached to come and pick up their kids. So I took some of my daughter's friends to our house for safekeeping. Everybody has their own unique September 11th story, but I look back and I think, at the time, what was that common sense we all had? Like, we'd been gut punched. Who were these people who attacked us? Why do they hate us? were we at war with an enemy that deliberately attacked innocents, would we ever be safe again? And what did it mean for the nation, the families, their children? And I think that if you were in Manhattan at that point, or really anywhere in the country, that confusion and despair hung over us like a shroud, just as the dust cloud created by the tower's collapse lingered for days throughout Manhattan and New York. I mean, I think those iconic pictures, a lot of which we'll see again today, of the towers burning and then collapsing, they still have that power to terrify us. But it's what happened in the days and months and years ahead that I think came to define us. And while we were still grieving, seamlessly helpless, a very different narrative started to emerge. We started seeing individual people and individual Americans, what were they made of? It was like common people doing uncommonly brave and noble things. And they were doing it naturally, instinctively, without being told what to do or government telling them how to do it. It was what we do best. I mean, we get pushed down, we get back up again. We innovate, we improvise. We show unimaginable courage and creativity and grit. And we don't scare easy. We don't shrink from evil. We fight it. We ultimately defeat it. I mean, I remember, as everyone does, the firefighters and paramedics and police, they were rushing past me. I was walking uptown. They were rushing past me, going into the burning towers to save people. And I think of personal stories I know of people who helped guide their fellow workers down long flights of stairs in the dark. I know one woman who was wheelchair-bound, and one of her colleagues carried her on his back for 50 flights and then went back up into the towers to rescue other people. There was a makeshift armada in Lower Manhattan of tourist boats and commuter ferries and private vessels. They sailed right into New York Harbor, and they evacuated 500,000 people who were trapped in Lower Manhattan. And then I remember also walking around Manhattan, and thousands of New Yorkers who just the day before would have been too impatient to wait for the light to change before crossing the street, they were lined up for hours by the thousands at hospitals waiting to donate blood. And then the passengers and crew on United Flight 93, they stormed the cockpit of their hijacked airport. They knew they were going to die, but they would rather have it hit the ground than let it fly to Washington and destroy the U.S. Capitol. And then even in the months ahead, when President Bush organized, got an authorization to use force against those who had killed us, and then within 3 weeks, we had a small contingent of American special forces. They innovated. They improvised. They went to Afghanistan to kill Al-Qaeda. And we had a high-tech military. We weren't equipped or trained to fight a bunch of terrorists in the most primitive, barren part of the world. But the forces adapted quickly, and within 3 months, they had destroyed all but just a handful of Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. I mean, tragically, there were a lot of mistakes and really poor decisions made by our political and military leaders after that, which lengthened the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq before bringing them, as we now know, to a tragic end. But I keep thinking back over the last 20 years. It's not we were defeated. It was wasn't the effort that was wasted in vain. It's the individual stories I saw when I went to Afghanistan. I was there and I met young girls, young school college graduates who were teaching Afghan girls how to read. I went to one place. There was a local farmers cooperative where Midwestern reservists who were patrolling the town then on their off hours went to teach the local farmers how to build solar power plants. I mean, I met American workers who were helping Afghan war widows set up small businesses in their homes to make clothing and jewelry. I even met the man, Stephen Kwan, who was head of a U.S. aid group of teaching Afghans how to grow soybeans. It was actually one of his workers who was the last person drowned, who was killed by mistake just 2 weeks ago. But anyway, there were these wonderful stories of Americans doing great things. And so I keep thinking that, we get down, but we get up. And after 20 years, okay, we've left Afghanistan, and it's been in the most chaotically, I think, almost criminally incompetent way. And we've left Americans behind. We've abandoned loyal Afghans who stood with us. The terrorists have the upper hand. The Taliban has their military equipment and bases. And here we are. We're gut-punched again. We're thinking, well, what's our future? What's our place in the world? What's our national purpose? And so I think that we're in many, this is a very difficult anniversary, because it's not like we're thinking about it in great glory. We're thinking about it in great tragedy.
We have so many emotions today, and we've had so many emotions as we've watched the events in Afghanistan. And kind of help us through this. What do we do about all of this?
Well, that's the question. I mean, I think the strength and beauty of our democracy is that we can replace our officials at the next election. And I suspect the American people are really in the mood for major historic change come 2022 and 24. Feckless, incompetent leaders, which is, I think, what we have today, they're parading as patriots. And, you know, Americans don't reelect feckless, incompetent leaders parading and stealing glory from others. I mean, we may make mistakes in whom we elect, but we have the means to correct those mistakes the next time around. And as we sort of cope with all that, I think it's really worth remembering not the incompetent leaders and the woke military guys who were everybody's blaming everybody else and the politicians and finger-pointing. I think it's just worth thinking about the average American once again. And think about those brave, hundreds of brave soldiers and Marines. They became human shields while thousands of our citizens were evacuated from the airport in Kabul. Or the American pilots. I mean, the son of a friend of mine was one of the pilots who sat on a Kabul runway for hours in 100-degree heat, ready to take off at the moment's notice. And we've all seen the stories of the pilots who overrode the recommendations on the flight manuals, and they packed their planes with refugees. They flew thousands of people to safety. And then most especially of those retired Special Forces Green Berets, the Navy SEALs, who in the last couple of weeks, they've refused to let their fellow Americans and former Afghan allies fall prey to the Taliban. They got no help from the U.S. government. In many cases, the State Department was trying to obstruct their rescue missions. But some of these brave patriots, they organized evacuation flights. Some of them actually headed back to Afghanistan. They crept into Kabul and rescued former colleagues and brought them to the airport checkpoint. And once that airport checkpoint was closed last week, others have been spirited out by these American citizens. They've been spirited out to cross the border from Afghanistan into other countries. And I, you know, I just keep thinking, Rick, this is what our adversaries never get about us. They don't get the nature of Americans. We're usually so busy building our own lives, we tend to leave the governing to our elected officials. And so people around the world, they look at us and they say, oh, those Americans, they're soft, they're lazy, they're spoiled. But underneath that layer is a backbone of steel. We are slow to act. We are slow to anger. But when we do get challenged and we are forced, we prove our mettle. And that can-do spirit, the self-reliance, is built into our national DNA, our resiliency. You know, we improvise, we innovate, we break a few rules, but we don't ever accept defeat. I mean, look at what happened after September 11th. Look at the last 20 years in Afghanistan. Look at the last couple of weeks. And I think our adversaries, you guys better take note. You know, we've been gut-punched in the past. Pearl Harbor, Sputnik, the Berlin airlift, Saigon, September 11th, and now Kabul. Every time our enemies danced with glee, predicting with great confidence our inevitable decline, but they've been wrong every single time. And rather than accept defeat, we always get up off our knees, we dust ourselves off, we climb out of the tragedy, and we achieve greater things in prosperity and purpose. I'm just reminded what the Japanese Admiral Yamamoto said to his colleagues after they celebrated their utter destruction of the American fleet at Pearl Harbor. He said, "I fear all we have done is awaken a sleeping giant and fill him with a terrible resolve." And within 4 years, the United States single-handedly defeated the combined forces of Japan, Germany, and Italy. Our adversaries don't ever count us out. And frankly, I think we need to remember that ourselves. We should never lose faith in ourselves.
K.T. McFarland, her opinion piece at FoxNews.com, published this morning, 20 years after 9/11, it's like we've been gut-punched again. Still, don't count Americans out. Defeat doesn't doom the American spirit. It reinvigorates it. K.T., thank you so much for being with us on this 20th anniversary of 9/11.
Thank you, and God bless everyone.
The news is next on WMAL. Thank you for being with us this morning.
WMAL-FM Woodbridge, Washington. Saluting America's heroes, 20 years later and always. 105.9 FM WMAL, a Cumulus station.